it is gone. A two-run home run for Rhys Hoskins into the second deck for Bryce Harper. Play and a miss. He got him. And Aaron Nola leads two. Segura on the run. Reaches up and makes the grab.
Swing and a miss. Struck him out.
Now batting for the Phillies, John Stolness.
Hey there, podcast pals, and welcome to another edition of Hittin' Season. This is episode number 360. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on Twitter at John Stolness. Lots to get to here on this episode of the podcast. Did you know it's the 100th anniversary of the Negro Leagues? And we're going to talk to the president of the Negro League Baseball Museum, Bob Kendrick, coming up in just a few minutes about the centennial of the Negro Leagues. Some Phillies players are airing their grievances against Gabe Kapler and Chris Young. We'll get into that. I'll also take some Phillies mailbag questions. Plus, I will have your stat of the week. But let's start things off with the Phillies players and the airing of grievances. It's as if Festivus came early this year. I mean, first of all, it's great just to see the full squad down in Clearwater, isn't it? I mean, you're getting videos of Rhys Hoskins' new stance, which is interesting, and we'll certainly be getting into that once we see it in game action a little bit. But it certainly looks interesting how he's got a new approach here at the start of the 2020 spring season. It'll be interesting to see. Spencer Howard was back on the mound on Wednesday after not having thrown for a little over a week and a half after tweaking his knee, and he's on a delayed program anyway. So it looks like he's fine, and it was just kind of a thing they wanted to be careful about. So it's good to see him throwing. I mean, there's a lot of awesome things going on in spring camp. I know the offseason is a time where we have to look at what they've done, and we can be dissatisfied with what they did. But I think at this point, let's get on board here with 2020, gang. I'm going to be on board here with 2020 because I do think the Phillies have put together a good baseball team here in 2020. I think they have a chance. I think, and I'll give you my prediction on what they're going to do this season at the end of the spring before we start the regular season. And I'm sure Justin and Liz and I will do a full preview of the season as we're about ready to start with the regular season. But one of the interesting storylines that we are seeing in Clearwater right now is the airing of grievances against former manager Gabe Kapler and former pitching coach Chris Young. And we're seeing it specifically with the pitchers. Jake Arrieta this week had some interesting things to say, and Arrieta always has some interesting things to say. One of my issues with Arrieta is that it seems from time to time as though he's looking to make excuses for maybe some of his poor performance. We remember a couple years ago he blamed the infield defense. No, I understand. At the time, that you had Scott Kingery, who was just learning shortstop, made a critical error in a game in San Francisco that upset Arrieta. And, you know, he obviously had the injury issues last year. Arrieta comes into camp 100% healthy, and now he's talking about how that there's been a transition from the Chris Young, Gabe Kapler era to what we're now seeing with Joe Girardi and Brian Price. And he said, there was a weird transition there for like 3 or 4 years. He's talking about baseball overall, and the insistence by many pitching coaches and many organizations for all of their pitchers to throw fastballs at the top of the zone and curveballs down at the bottom of the zone. And Arrieta said, as smart as a lot of these analytical teams are, they miss some of the most obvious signs of not needing to do that as often, talking about high fastballs. Guys that don't have mid to upper 90s fastballs, guys that don't have a 12-6 or an above average curveball. Taking guys that throw sinkers and transitioning them to a guy that throws four-seamers up. It's happened all around baseball, and it's foolish. He went on to say, look, we're the guys out there on the mound with the ball. We know what our stuff is. We know how it works. We should know what works best, and if you don't, you need to figure it out. You shouldn't have to have somebody tell you that. And a lot of this was geared towards conversation about Zach Eflin, and we all know the storyline with Eflin last year, that he started the season with some success throwing high fastballs and trying to go low curveballs, but he couldn't maintain it. He couldn't sustain it during the course of the whole season. And he went back towards the end of the season doing what he does best, and that's to throw sinkers down and away. Arrieta said, talking about Eflin, you know, young guys want to be coachable. He said, I've been in similar situations. You believe that everybody has your best interests in mind, but sometimes those things aren't meant for you. So you have to be able to filter the information you're given, be realistic with yourself, and self-evaluate. He also stressed that Chris Young, the former pitching coach who's now with the Cubs as their bullpen coach, he said, Young did a lot of good here, and there was a lot of great information that he gave the guys, and it definitely wasn't just him. But Arrieta also said that he doesn't like the trend that he's seen in the last few years when it comes to pitching up in the zone. And he said he encouraged Eflin to do his own thing last year. Because he said it's not an easy situation to deal with when you're being pulled in a couple of different directions and you're unsure what to do. He said Eflin is in a better place now. He said he's got beautiful mechanics, he's got really good command and action on everything, it's real stuff. And then Arrieta said something I thought was eye-opening. He said, this is nothing against Wheeler or Nola because they're both great, but Eflin is just as good. There should be excitement about this guy. So Arrieta talking Eflin up and seeming to think that he's going to have a much better time of it with Gabe Kapler and Chris Young out and Brian Price in. But he wasn't the only veteran pitcher to say something about this. Aaron Nola spoke up. And now, of all people, if Aaron Nola is voicing displeasure about something, you know things must have been going on last season that really weren't good. And I think it's pretty clear. If you listen to these comments, Aaron Nola did not care for what Gabe Kapler or what Chris Young was trying to do. Talking about Brian Price, Nola said, he knows how to run things, and he's not going to change how the game is played. Look, you don't get a whole lot more fiery from Aaron Nola than that. Basically saying here, and I'm reading between the lines, but inferring that Chris Young didn't know how to run things, that Gabe Kapler didn't know how to run things, and that they were trying to change the way the game is played. You have to have buy-in from players if you're going to do this kind of stuff. And I think Kapler and Chris Young did not have buy-in, specifically from the pitching staff, with what they were trying to do. And Nola said, it's so important because not everybody's the same. Not everybody can throw fastballs up and blow it by guys. I can do it maybe once, but if I do it again, the hitter will time it up. The whole point is to change eye levels, change speeds. He said, ground balls still work. Balls down in the zone still work. I don't think that's ever going to get away from the game. As kids, we all learned, throw the ball down, throw the ball at the knees, get ground balls early in the count. Don't try to strike the guy out at the beginning of the at-bat when it's an 0-0 count. That's what Brian stresses. And so here's Aaron Nola talking about Brian Price, emphasizing the way pitchers have always tried to pitch. And we see that in a lot of cases, the Astros and the Nationals have had a lot of success with guys throwing high fastballs and curveballs down. You can do that when you have Max Scherzer and Steven Strasburg. You can do that when you have Justin Verlander and Gerrit Cole. You can't necessarily do that when you have Jake Arrieta and Aaron Nola and Zach Eflin. Nick Pivetta seems like a guy whose stuff would be good for that sort of a scenario, but maybe not. You have to have good control of your fastball if you're going to pitch that way. And Nick Pivetta, I don't think, has great control of his fastball. So at the end of the year last year, when the season was over and everybody was speculating what the Phillies were going to do with Gabe Kapler, we all heard players saying nice things about Gabe Kapler, and we heard them say nice things about Chris Young. But I think reading these quotes now, that it's clear a lot of that lip service was because they weren't sure if Kapler and Young were going to be back and they were hedging their bets. I think you're seeing players, and I think this is going to manifest itself in wins on the field in 2020, who are so relieved to have Joe Girardi in the manager's office and relieved to have Brian Price as their pitching coach. And I think this is going to hold true for Joe Dillon as the hitting coach. I think these players are going to feel so much more relieved that they know they have someone there who's been there, who's done it, who's not trying to reinvent the wheel. And I think they feel confident in their leadership. I don't think Phillies players and pitchers felt confident in the game plan and the mission and the messaging coming from the manager's office and from the pitching coach last year. These quotes from Arrieta and Nola bear that out to me. I think these guys are thrilled to have a coaching staff that speaks their language. Now, this isn't to say that the new staff isn't going to use the data that's coming from the front office, because they are. The Phillies have invested heavily in an analytics department. It's not going anywhere. But I don't think these coaches, and I don't think this manager, is going to force players into doing things that they can't physically do. And as I sit and I hear Aaron Nola talk and I hear Jake Arrieta talk, I really wonder whether the last 2 years were a complete and total waste. I mean, did the Gabe Kapler decision set this franchise back 2 years? I say yes. I see what the Phillies were trying to do in bringing in Gabe Kapler, and it could have worked. There's a chance it could have worked, but it didn't work. And the fact that it didn't work, it set this organization's rebuild back 2 years. Because I believe if Pete Maccannon had stayed on as manager and Bob McClure had stayed on as pitching coach, the Phillies would have made the playoffs in 2018 or 2019. I don't think you have those late season collapses in those two seasons if Pete Maccannon is the manager. Pete Maccannon had that team playing well at the end of 2017 when they let him go. And I really believe Maccannon, given an opportunity, could have utilized and worked in the analytics. And I really think that looking back on it, I think that was a mistake. Or at the very least, they could have brought in a manager that wasn't trying to do things in such a crazy way that could have made some sense. But it's clear Gabe Kapler and Chris Young, they were not on the same page with the players. And it's pretty clear to me. I mean, you saw with the Carlos Santana bashing in the clubhouse TVs that this clubhouse was not humming on all cylinders. That they needed a boss in the room. That this was a team full of some young players and some veterans, but who had never all played before. There needed to be buy-in. And I don't think there was buy-in these last 2 years. I mean, everything that was happening with the previous regime, I think, was detrimental to the players. And the players are voicing that frustration now in spring training, now that they have Joe Girardi in place, now that they have Brian Price in place. And you know what? These last 2 years with Gabe Kapler in there and Chris Young in there and you know, them not being able to get over the hump, that's on Matt Klentak. He made the decision. That was a risky call, hiring Gabe Kapler, and they knew it at the time. They knew it at the time that hiring Gabe Kapler was a risky call. It could have worked. If you believe that it was worth the experiment, that it was worth the try, that's fine. I don't agree because we lost 2 years of valuable time there. I don't see how this team grew, with the exception of some wins. They didn't show enough progress. You know, these last 2 years were disappointing. That's what they were. They were disappointing. The Gabe Kapler experiment obviously didn't work because it only lasted 2 years. And I think you could say it set the team back 2 years. I wonder where this team would be now if they had made a different decision with the manager and the pitching coach, because it's clear to me they didn't have buy-in from these players, and players were frustrated with what was going on. So I'm glad that Joe Girardi's here. I'm glad Brian Price is here. We'll see if it pays off in more wins this year. I think it definitely will, and I think there's just a different air, a different feel down in spring training for the Phillies right now. This team seems hungry to me, guys. They seem hungry to me. This seems like a team that really knows it needs to win now. It wants to win now. I think they know they have talent in place. I'm not sure about the pitching staff. I'm really, really not. I'm not sure about the bullpen. There's question marks in the lineup, but there is a lot of talent on this team. If they get just a little bit of luck to go their way this year, and they had no luck go their way last season, this is a team that I think can make the playoffs. I really do think they can make the playoffs. They got to have some things go right, but this baseball team is due to have some things go right. And we'll talk more about that here over the next few podcasts as well. Well, coming up, we're going to get into the Phillies mailbag before we talk to Bob Kendrick from the Negro Leagues Museum. We'll answer some of your mailbag questions that you all sent me on Twitter. We'll do that next right here on Hittin' Season. All right, let's jump into the Phillies mailbag here, and let's start off with a question from at GumballTJ2. It goes by the tagline number one spring training fan. He asks, if Alec Bohm has a good spring and solid success in the minors early on in the year, do you think they fast track him or do they play the service time game? Here's the deal with Bohm. I don't think he's coming up until after his service time has accrued for another year, which is probably like mid-May. But I don't think it really matters because I don't think he's going to be ready until then. Even if he hits 400 in spring training and bashes 8 home runs, we've all seen that spring training stats a lot of times don't mean a whole lot. It'll do him good to get more time regularly playing third base in the minor leagues, get him some more reps down there, get him some reps facing AAA pitching. He's never seen a single pitch at AAA. There's no rush on this guy. You've got Kingery who can play third, or Segura who can play third, and Kingery playing second base or whoever. And you can start the season with Adam Haseley in center field until Alec Bohm shows you a couple of months down in AAA that he's ready to come up. And then if that happens, you have him for 4 months at the big league level. I don't see a need to rush Alec Bohm, even if he has a good spring. But I do think he is going to be on this team if he has a couple of good months down in AAA. And at that point, the service time thing doesn't matter. Once June rolls around, the service time thing doesn't matter. He's already accrued another full season of team control. So it doesn't really affect Alec Bohm like it did Michael Franco a few years ago when he had already seen a lot of time in AAA and was closer to being ready to play. Alec Bohm's really close, but a couple of months in the minors won't hurt him at all. Ken Raining at Hive Husband asks, how committed do you think the Phillies are to Rhys Hoskins? Is there any pressure on him within the organization to produce after what most saw as a down year? I think there's some pressure on Rhys Hoskins, and I think you're seeing that with the fact that he's got a dramatically altered swing, at least early in spring training so far. The key will be, if he struggles, what does he do? Does he fall back into bad habits, or does he keep that swing? We have to see if the swing's going to be effective in game situations. We've seen with players that they can tweak their mechanics, they can tinker with their swing in batting practice and in spring games, and then when they go up north, it doesn't stay with them. I think that's something to keep an eye on. Rhys Hoskins just got himself out a lot last year. I think he's too talented a hitter to be that bad. I do think he's probably a Pat Burrell type player, and I've mentioned that before. And that's probably what you're going to get from Rhys Hoskins as the ceiling in his career, and that's fine. Pat Burrell was a better hitter than most people remember. He had a couple really bad seasons. One in particular, like, was 0-3, where he hit like 2-13. And that's kind of what Rhys Hoskins had last year. I think that was his Pat Burrell 2003 season. Did I say 13 a minute ago? I might have. I think that was his Pat Burrell-esque 2003 season. I think you're going to see a bounce back from Hoskins. Do I think there's some pressure? Sure. I think there's pressure on him to perform. Now, this is his third full season with Alec Bohm waiting in the wings, and no one's sure if Bohm can be the full-time third baseman for his career. His future might be at first base. You can tell the Phillies are not all in on Rhys Hoskins because they haven't engaged in contract extension negotiations. If you hear that happening, then you know that they might be more all in on Hoskins than anyone thinks, but there has been no reason to engage in those kinds of talks just yet. So I think Rhys Hoskins does have some things to prove here in 2020, no doubt about it. Brennan M. Weiss asks, do you think the player fan backlash to the Astros scandal will affect how Manfred goes about punishing the Red Sox when he releases his report? That's a really good question. I don't think it can, though. I don't think he can penalize Red Sox players if he didn't penalize Astros players, no matter what the blowback is. And I think a lot of that has to do with the Players Association. They came out with a statement this week that says that they worked with Major League Baseball and they were assured by Major League Baseball that players would not be suspended in exchange for the players not being suspended. You would think that a similar deal has been reached with the Red Sox, but who knows? I mean, I'm not on the inside, so there's no way to say, but I don't think you can have one set of rules for the Red Sox and a different set of rules for the Astros. That's just not going to be fair. I think the Players Union would be up in arms about that, rightfully so. So I know that Manfred is probably under a lot of pressure for the massive amount of criticism he's receiving for the penalties laid out against the Astros and the fact that no Astros players were suspended, but I don't think he can suspend Red Sox players as a result of that pressure. At Mr. Jersey Josh asks, he asked this initial question back in July of 2017. The record for Phillies only sending one player to the All-Star game in consecutive years is 6. They are at 4. Will this record be broken? And he revisited that question this week. He said, same question, except the record is now at 6 and could be broken this year. I really believe this is the year that streak breaks, that they get more than one player in the All-Star game. I think Bryce Harper, if he gets off to a good start, makes the All-Star team. I'd like to think Aaron Nola could make the All-Star team. I think Didi Gregorius, if he bounces back and has a season like we're hoping he'll have, he'll be an All-Star shortstop. And then after that, you know, I don't know. There might not be a whole lot of options JT Realmuto. I'm forgetting all about Realmuto. He's almost certainly going to make the All-Star team. So I think there will be. I think there will be more than one. Will there be more than two? Maybe not. But I think the Phillies are going to get off to a better start. I think some of these guys are going to get off to better starts this year. And that means more likely that you'll have more than one All-Star make the All-Star team this year. At FlyGuyJosh91 asks, what do you think MLB will do for penalties involving players that throw at Houston players. I'm curious because it's hard to suspend them if you haven't suspended documented cheaters, so how will they control player safety? Well, you can suspend a player for throwing at a hitter. Whether or not, you know, that hitter's been suspended for cheating in the past, you know, whatever the motive that pitcher might have to throw at that hitter, if Major League Baseball deems that the hitter was being thrown at intentionally, no matter what the reason, yes, that pitcher can be suspended, and that pitcher probably will be suspended, and that pitcher probably should be suspended, even if they are on the side of the Angels. But I think not the California Angels or the Anaheim Angels, the baseball Angels, the Angels of life. I do think Major League Baseball will hand down the typical suspension. They've already come out and said that they're going to be making sure that Astros players aren't targeted. You might see pitchers get larger suspensions if it's all part of a targeting. So, you know, they're certainly going to be suspended. The Major League Baseball is not going to turn a blind eye to it. Will it be a larger suspension because of everything going on? I doubt it, but I wouldn't put it out. I wouldn't say it's out of the realm of possibility. At Off the Mark Tweet asks, what do you think the strategy will be for the 26th roster spot? Extra arm, third catcher, Roman Quinn insurance. My guess is they probably go with an extra bullpen arm. They could go with a third catcher, but I don't think they have a real need for a third catcher outside of Andrew Knapp. I mean, I guess they could go with a third catcher in that situation, but my guess is it's a good question. I think it's a lot of it is going to shake out with how these players, some of these bench players, and how some of these guys in the bullpen perform in spring. If they're not sure about what their bullpen's going to look like, they might just carry an extra arm because they're not sure what they're going to have and what they're going to need. I think there's less of a need for that 26th man to be used for an extra bench player. But if they have a set of arms they really like, and they're not sure about, you know, getting an extra shortstop on the roster or somebody who can play center field, then, you know, maybe they do add a 26th roster spot. I really don't have a good sense for it right now. I can see needing Roman Quinn insurance for sure, but right now the only other center fielder is Odubel Herrera. And I don't think he's making the 26-man roster out of spring training. So Roman Quinn insurance, I don't really think is a thing at the moment. At JBS in Space One asks, McCutcheon timeline, in terms of return to the lineup and actually being 100%, don't see ACLs in baseball as often as other sports. I agree. I mean, I think he starts the season. I think he starts the season open. I think he's on the opening day, in the opening day lineup, playing center field. Playing left field and leading off. Do I think he's 100%? No, I don't think he'll be 100% at the start of the season. And I am concerned about Andrew McCutcheon. I know he's not concerned. I am. You know, coming off an ACL tear, and he's getting up there in years. I mean, he's not up there like he's 40, but for a player coming off an ACL tear, he's not a spring chicken anymore. And I'm concerned that he's not going to be as effective as he was at the start of last year. Because frankly, I was surprised that he was as effective as he was at the start of last year. So am I sure that Andrew McCutcheon is going to be in the opening day lineup? I'm about 90% sure he's in the opening day lineup as the team's leadoff hitter. I don't know that he's going to be as effective as he was last year. That is certainly a big storyline to watch during the first month of the season. At Fred J. Stanley asks, assuming good health, who plays third base, second base, and center field in September? Also, over-under on Bohm's plate appearances this year. Good questions. Right now, I think the Phillies are leaning towards starting with Segura at third, Kingery at second, and Haseley in center. I think you end up seeing Bohm at third base, Kingery at second base. I think you see Gene Segura traded at some point this year. I think they wanted to do that this offseason. I think Adam Haseley's going to play pretty well. And I think you might see Roman Quinn get some plate appearances to give him a break against some tough left-handed pitchers. You'll probably see Kingery play some center field, and the Phillies try and figure something out at second base. You might see the Phillies add a second baseman at the trade deadline, and then you play Kingery in center. I think Haseley's going to be pretty good. I don't think he's going to hit the cover off the ball, but I think he's going to be good enough to be usable in center so that you don't make Kingery the full-time center fielder. So I think Alec Bohm is your third baseman in September. I think Scott Kingery is your second baseman in September. I think Adam Haseley is largely your center fielder in September. I think Gene Segura is on another team. But in September, and then they figure out a right-handed platoon to go with Adam Haseley in center field in September. Let's see. What else do we have here? Harper Tazo asks, what do you think are realistic best-case scenario performances by Alec Boehm and Spencer Howard in Major League Baseball this year? I didn't answer the over-under on plate appearances for Boehm. I would say, let's see, if he's called up in June, I'd say he probably gets... I'd say 370 plate appearances. Let's go with 370 plate appearances for Alec Boehm this year at the big league level. That would be a lot. That would be a lot. And that's maybe 350. Let's go with 350. 350 plate appearances for Alec Boehm here in 2020. The best case scenario? Well, I mean, the ceiling is that Spencer Howard, I think, pitches 100 innings at the big league level and gives you a 3 ERA. I think with Boehm, I think he gives you the best case scenario is he gives you 400 plate appearances and he hits you 20 home runs. Hits like 260 with a 320 on base, something like that. Slugging percentage in the high 400s. I think that's a really, really good ceiling for a good season for rookies getting their first action in the big leagues. At 311 Rambo, how many lefties do you think they will hold in the bullpen and who? Right now, I got Adam Morgan, I've got Jose Alvarez, and I think Francisco Liriano makes the team as left-handers out of the bullpen. Listen, I think let's hold off on there for Twitter podcast questions for right now. We'll get to some more with Justin and Liz on episode 361, and we'll let them weigh in on some of these questions as well. So up next, we're going to talk to Bob Kendrick, the president of the Negro League Baseball Museum, as the Negro League celebrate their 100th anniversary. We'll do that next right here on Hit Season. Well, the Negro League celebrates its centennial this year, and there's going to be a lot of talk around Major League Baseball about it. I'm sure Major League Baseball is going to do a lot of things to celebrate the anniversary. And joining us to talk a little bit about what the year has in store is Bob Kendrick. He's the president of the Negro League's Baseball Museum in Kansas City, Missouri. You can follow the museum on Twitter at NLBMPrez. Bob, thank you so much for coming on Hit and Season. I appreciate it. How are you?
John, I'm doing great, man. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
I'm very excited to talk to you about this because my son, he's 9, and he's a huge baseball fan, and it's amazing to me. He's such a huge baseball history fan. Like his favorite books are the ones that look at the origins of the game. He likes looking at the old gloves and the old teams. You know, researching who won the World Series back in 1925, and he's really interested in the Negro Leagues as well. And so that's one of the big reasons why I wanted to talk to you today, is because this is a big year for you guys. I mean, the 100th anniversary of the league itself, but also you have an anniversary at the museum also this year, don't you?
We do. We're in the midst of certainly celebrating a national event such as the centennial of the Negro Leagues. You know, we want to also make sure that people understand that this is the 30th anniversary of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. We established this museum in 1990 in a little one-room office, John, at historic 18th and Vine. And when we started this project, there was nothing at historic 18th and Vine, which sadly had been, you know, it's sad to say, because it had been once a prominent African-American community during that era of American segregation, but like a lot of urban areas, it had died. And here we come along in 1990, establishing the Negro Leagues Museum in a little one-room office led by the late, great Buck O'Neill and other Negro Leaguers who literally took turns paying the monthly rent to keep the little office open. That's how we got started, man. So we are as grassroots an organization as you will ever encounter. No one gave it any chance of succeeding. And here we are now, 30 years later, recognized as America's National Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. So it's been an incredible journey that almost mirrors the rise of the Negro Leagues for the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
So if people go to the museum, what will they see there when they get there?
Oh, man, you're going to basically encounter a piece of Americana that you didn't know. And you're going to see it through the lens of baseball and some incredible baseball players. I call them unsung baseball heroes. But there are players that you should know and most don't know. But you're also going to take this amazing nostalgic journey. And again, through the lens of baseball, you're going to watch not only the rise and subsequent fall of the Negro Leagues, but you're literally going to witness the social rise of America simultaneously. Mm-hmm. You have to remember that this is the league that gave us Jackie Robinson. And I think a lot of people, John, don't understand that Jackie Robinson's illustrious, groundbreaking professional career began in the Negro Leagues, 1945, here in Kansas City with the great Kansas City Monarchs. And so it was our city and the Negro Leagues that gave America arguably its greatest hero in Jackie Robinson. And there's no question about it. And we make that assertion that Robinson's breaking of the color barrier wasn't just a part of the civil rights movement. It was actually the beginning of the civil rights movement in this country. And so all of this comes to life when you walk through the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. And so it combines, I think, everything that is great about this country. And so I tell people all the time, if you are a fan of American history, you're going to love the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. If you are a fan of the underdog overcoming adversity to go on to greatness, you're going to love the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. But if, man, you're a baseball fan to boot, you are in hog heaven. It combines everything, all of those things, so beautifully and so intimately and so inspirationally as our visitors come in and discover this amazing, once untold piece of Americana.
I want to get into some more of the players in just a second, because you're right. I mean, just an unbelievable amount of talent came through the Negro Leagues, and most of which didn't end up in the major leagues for a large portion of the league's history. But I want to talk about the start of the Negro Leagues. I mean, people know it was in existence and people know about it, but I don't really know how the Negro Leagues itself got started 100 years ago. How did the league come to be? What were its origins?
Yeah, 100 years ago, Rube Foster, the great Andrew Rube Foster, led a contingent of 8 independent black baseball team owners into a meeting here in Kansas City at a building called the Paseo YMCA. The building still stands. As a matter of fact, John, we went back into that old historic landmark on February 13th for the actual 100th anniversary commemoration of the Negro Leagues. But it was Rube Foster who led that group of 8 independent black baseball team owners into Kansas City. They met, and out of that meeting on February 13th, 1920, they established the Negro National League, the first successful organized black baseball league. Now, there had been other attempts, but they had all failed. But Rube Foster had the juice. Yeah, mm-hmm. Rube Foster had the foresight and the vision to create this league that would mirror Major League Baseball. And his, as we like to call it, his Declaration of Independence was a simple quote that said, "We are the ship, all else the sea." He was sending notification to Major League Baseball that a new player had arrived on the scene to be reckoned with. And those leagues would then operate amazingly from 1920 until 1960, 40 years. Jackie Robinson breaks the color barrier in 1947. 13 years after Jackie breaks the color barrier, the Negro Leagues are still operating. Yeah. But when we look back historically, we discover that it took Major League Baseball 12 years before every Major League team had at least one black baseball player. The Boston Red Sox will become the last team to integrate in 1959 when they signed Pumpsy Green. So that's really what afforded the Negro Leagues an opportunity to continue to do business. But really by 1955, Negro Leagues baseball had been reduced to minor league at best, because you know, you had started siphoning off the great stars, and the black fan base left the Negro Leagues to see how their great black stars were going to fare now that they finally had an opportunity to play in the major leagues.
So the Negro Leagues, obviously, like you mentioned, they fade once Major League Baseball and integrates fully. So I guess it's kind of a bittersweet thing. You know, you have
this
great league with all these great players, something that the African-American community calls their own. But the goal is obviously to get these players to be fully integrated in Major League Baseball. So, yes, it's kind of bittersweet then, yeah?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And the bitter part is the fact that I'm not sure the African-American community realized what it was losing when it lost the Negro Leagues, because when we start to look off the field, the impact that the Negro Leagues had, particularly as a catalyst for black businesses and the base of support that it was creating for black businesses, was lost, because Robinson's breaking of the color barrier not only created integration in baseball, it was the impetus for integration in a much more widespread fashion. And so what segregation actually had done was it forced ownership. And so here in Kansas City, great example, African Americans could only move within about a 13 block radius in Kansas City. Couldn't go outside those 13 blocks. But within those 13 blocks, you had everything you needed and more. And it was being driven in large part by the success of the great Kansas City Monarchs, who were bringing these segregated, mandated businesses a built-in clientele. When the Monarchs played here in Kansas City, man, the stadium, I think, at that time held about 17,000. That was before they put the upper deck on, which eventually became Municipal Stadium. When the Monarchs played, it's standing room only. And all these folks were coming back to historic 18th and Vine, where the museum is located, and they were doing business with those segregated, mandated black-owned businesses. So when you lost the Negro Leagues, you lost that catalyst. And the other side of the equation is that older Negro Leagues player got put out of business. Yeah, and these black owners who had built a business enterprise behind black baseball, they too lost. So, yeah, it's bittersweet, but it was progress.
Yeah.
And it was good for the soul of our country. And it moved us in ways socially that I'm not sure we ever fathomed possible at that time.
I saw an interview that you did on the MLB Network with Harold Reynolds, and you were talking about some of the innovations that came from the Negro Leagues as far as Major League Baseball. And I was particularly interested in what you were talking about with night games, that I did not realize that originated with you guys.
Yeah, most folks don't. The great J.L. Wilkinson, who owned the Kansas City Monarchs, literally mortgaged everything he had to pioneer night baseball. Portable generated light towers. So, John, not only could they play a night game here in Kansas City, they could load them up on the truck and play a night game virtually anywhere.
That's great.
And see, the history book says that the first professional night baseball game took place 1935, Crosley Field, Cincinnati, Ohio, Cincinnati Reds versus Philadelphia Phillies. Well, the history book is wrong. That first professional night baseball game, 1930, and it featured our very own Kansas City Monarchs. And by the time they played that game in Cincinnati, honest to God's truth, the Monarchs in the House of David had taken night baseball all the way out to Seattle. And as I said in that clip with Harold, and we've had a lot of fun recording those vignettes, Wilkie wasn't looking to be innovative. He was doing it for survival, because the Negro Leagues had been primarily relegated to playing on Sundays. And so he was looking for a way to get the working class fan into the ballpark. Back then, Major League Baseball really didn't play on Sundays. So the Negro Leagues would rent the ballpark, play that Sunday doubleheader. And as I oftentimes like to say, we left church going straight to the ballpark, dressed to the nine, looking good.
Yeah.
And so he was looking for a way to get the working class fan into the ballpark. Night baseball became the answer. Night baseball became bigger than Sunday games. That's how popular it was. And so, yeah, these kinds of innovations came out of the Negro Leagues, a style of play that was certainly prototypical Negro Leagues, fast, aggressive, daring. So they were bunting their way on. They were stealing second, stealing third. Man, if you weren't too smart, they were stealing home. But even advents such as shin guards and the batting helmet, these things all come out of Negro Leagues or black baseball history, and nobody knew about it. You know, so it's important that you bring these stories to the forefront. And that's the role of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum.
Yeah, I was going to say, what other these are the kinds of things that people can expect over this year as you guys celebrate. But what kind? You guys have any special exhibits planned or any special events planned this year?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, we just opened on February 13th a beautiful art exhibit featuring the works of Greg Kreiler, who is an amazing young artist who does color studies. He goes back and researches these old and finds and digs these old photographs up, going all the way back to 19th century black baseball, and then he colorizes them. And so the research that goes in this is extraordinary. The actual artistic execution is amazing. Over 200 of his works are on display right now in our changing gallery at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. That exhibit will run, and we call it Black Baseball in Living Color. That exhibit will run through May 31st. Come April 15th, we open up a new permanent installation at the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum called Barrier Breakers. And, John, the Barrier Breaker exhibit will chronicle all of the players who broke their respective Major League teams' color barriers. We know the story of Jackie Robinson substantially and very intimately, and rightfully so. He was that pioneering first. But the other guys, we don't know their story. And as I mentioned, it took 12 years. And so these guys deserve to be more than just a footnote in baseball history. It's only been over the last decade or so that we finally started paying, I think, rightful tribute to the great Larry Doby, who would break the color barrier in the American League just weeks after Jackie does it in the National League. But that's how we are as a society. We remember the first. We never remember the second.
Yeah.
And if you're number 16, you can pretty much forget it. And so it's incumbent upon, I think, our museum, again, to bring these stories to light. And so that exhibit will open in a permanent installation at the museum on Jackie Robinson Day, April 15th, officially. And then we're also creating a traveling component of that exhibition as well. It will be our number 7th national traveling exhibition. And so people who are listening to this conversation today, if you're interested in getting a Negro Leagues exhibit into your area, please be sure to reach out to us. We would love to partner with as many communities as we possibly can to bring this story on the road, as we like to say, barnstorming, to take it out to communities so that they can be introduced to this story. We have an exhibit right now on display at the Yogi Berra Museum in Montclair, New Jersey. Mm-hmm. So if you're in that area, please get over there to Yogi's Place and see our Discover Greatness exhibition, a photographic illustration of the Negro Leagues. And so, yeah, so it is really a big year for us. And as you may have heard, as we made the big announcement on February 13th with the commissioner in town and mm-hmm. Players Association represented, and Major League Baseball and the Players Association very generously donated $1 million in support of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. But we also announced a National Day of Recognition. Saturday, June 27th, all 30 Major League Baseball teams, in a historic show of solidarity, will pay honor to the Negro Leagues by wearing our commemorative patch on the sleeve of their uniform and hopefully acknowledging and tip just a simple tip of the cap. Yeah, and you know in our sport, there's nothing more honorable than tipping your cap.
No doubt about it.
And so to have players and fans stand in acknowledgement of the history of the Negro Leagues with a simple tip of the cap, I think is going to be a chilling moment, an inspirational moment for all 2,600 of those who played in the Negro Leagues, but certainly for this museum, and I think for baseball fans worldwide.
Last question for you. You mentioned Jackie Robinson a couple times, and Larry Doby, obviously, like you said, broke the color barrier in the American League, but so many players came through that league, and you mentioned that there are so many of them that were amazing players that history and time has kind of forgotten about. Who would you say is the best player to ever play in the Negro Leagues? I mean, that's a lot to sift through. I mean, I'm sure you'll get some people say Josh Gibson. I'm sure Satchel Paige's name comes up. But is there someone that that you would say is the best player to ever play in that league?
Well, let me frame it this way. Buck O'Neill, who I have the utmost respect for, he was involved in this game for 70 years. And he signed Ernie Banks and Lou Brock and, you know, and most recently his Hall of Famer is Lee Smith. Signed all these guys, played against some of the greatest to ever play. And he says without hesitation, it was Oscar Charleston, the great Oscar Charleston. The old timers in the Negro League say that Oscar Charleston was Willie Mays before we ever knew who Willie Mays was. And then there are others who will say that the closest thing to Oscar Charleston would have been Willie Mays. Yeah, Charleston was the consummate five-tool guy, hit for power, hit for average, could field, could run, could throw. In 1921, he led the Negro Leagues in home runs, triples, doubles, stolen bases, batting average in the same season. The great Bill James had him ranked number 4 on his all-time greatest list.
Wow.
But again, Buck O'Neill would say without hesitation, he's the greatest he ever saw. And for me, though, it's Josh Gibson. What Gibson did as a catcher is just is unprecedented. Because we're talking about not only a guy who had great power, and for those who may be hearing this name for the first time, he was called the Black Babe Ruth. But there are others who saw Gibson play who would call Ruth the white Josh Gibson. He was incredible. Yeah. So he not only combined his great power, but he also hit for high average. We're talking about a catcher who was a great defensive catcher, who had a lifetime batting average of .354. And in head-to-head competition against major leaguers in countless exhibition games, hit over .420. And Buck O'Neill, John, would describe Gibson in this manner, that he had the eyes of Ted Williams and the power of Babe Ruth wrapped into one dynamic package. Wow. And I can tell you this, everywhere Josh played, he hit. Hmm. And everywhere Josh played, his teams won. And that is not a coincidence. So, that's the beauty of baseball. You can make this argument endlessly on who you think is the best. Because, quite frankly, the early era Negro Leaguers or black baseball players don't get a lot of love, because when I got introduced to this story, I'm hearing it through the lens and the eyes of Buck O'Neill and Monty Irvin. Well, they played in the 30s and 40s, and that was their contemporaries. And so, you know, they don't oftentimes, so the John Henry Pop Lloyds of the world, the Spotwood Poles of the world, they don't get quite the love that they probably deserve because, again, the guys who saw them by the time I got involved, they were long gone. But when you start to talk in a little bit more contemporary fashion, those are the names that come into mind as the best. Charleston and Gibson, you can't go wrong. And Satchel was certainly on just another stratospheric level, you know, as a pitcher. And pitchers don't always get that recognition as the best because they had one thing to do, and they were doing it every fourth day. But, you know, in Satchel's case, he was doing it every day.
Yeah.
He pitched two or three innings almost every day.
Wow.
And everybody wanted to see him. He was the Negro League's biggest star, hands down, was Satchel Paige.
Well, this is the year, if you haven't been to the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum, and I haven't been yet, but this is making me want to go. I mean, this is the year to do it, folks. So for the 100th anniversary of the league, for the 30th anniversary of the museum, get yourself down to Kansas City and check it out. Bob Kendrick, president of the Negro Leagues Baseball Museum. You can follow the museum on Twitter at NLBMPrez. Mr. Kendrick, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it.
Well, John, I appreciate it as well. And for those who might be so inclined, we launched a grassroots fundraising campaign called 100 for 100. And you can learn more about that campaign at nlbm.com/centennial to see and maybe consider helping us make sure that this museum is around to lead the next 100 years of Negro Leagues history.
All right, well, let's finish things up here with our stat of the week, and this comes to us via Matt Eddy on Twitter, at Matt Eddy BA. The Phillies have handily committed the most total dollars to free agents the past two off-seasons. In terms of millions of dollars, the Phillies have spent $535 million on free agents. The Nationals come in second at $495 million, followed by the Yankees in third at $476. The Padres in fourth at $370 million, most of that going to Machado. And the Angels at number five at $295 million, again, most of that going to Mike Trout. So again, the Phillies, I don't understand their ideas about the luxury tax, but they have not been cheap. They handed out $330 million to Bryce Harper, $118 million to Zach Wheeler, $50 million to Andrew McCutchen, $23 million to David Robertson, and $14 million to Didi Gregorius over the last 2 years. Again, more than any other team over the past two off seasons. All right, gang, that'll do it for this episode of Hittin' Season. My thanks to Mr. Kendrick for once again coming on the podcast. And gang, check out the Hittin' Season Patreon. You can hear brand new podcasts that are only for Patreon members from Justin Clue and Chris Jones. It's called Absolutely Hammered. Go to patreon.com/hittin'season and sign up on the $5 a month tier. You'll get those bonus podcasts. You'll get extra bonus material from Justin and Liz. You'll get extra video material from me there. So again, it's at patreon.com/hittin'season where you can get lots of great bonus content there. Thanks everybody for tuning in. I'll talk to you all next time right here on Hittin' Season.